23. Monk's Corner, South Carolina, April 14, 1780, 3 a.m. Lieutenant Colonel Bannister Tarleton does not trust his horse. The proud commander of the British Legion canters silently through the swamps of South Carolina astride an inferior beast. The officer is 25 and brown-haired, his strong jaw and aquiline nose just a shade too large for his narrow face. Tarleton's own mount and those of his men did not survive the rough sea passage from New York City to Charlotte, South Carolina 4 months ago. So now he rides into battle on a stolen horse, in total darkness, unsure of whether his new mount will spook at the sound of gunfire. The moon is waxing, but a thick tree canopy allows Tarleton's 650 men to travel undetected. Tarleton's men enlisted in America, and the ranks include both American and British-born loyalists eager to be of service to the king, formed into a new combined corps of cavalry and infantry. At this moment, the soldiers are exhausted and famished, having already marched 5 hours with little food and water in the dead of night. The hardship will soon end, or so they hope. The 500-man American outpost at Cooper River is near. Once the battle against the rebels is won, there will be plenty of time to sate their needs from the abundant American supplies and to enjoy hard-earned sleep. 715 miles north in Morristown, New Jersey, General George Washington and the soldiers of the Continental Army are enduring the coldest winter of the 18th century, even colder than the winter spent in Valley Forge 2 years ago. The oldest people now living in this country do not remember so hard a winter as the one we are now emerging from. In a word, the severity of the frost exceeded anything of the kind that had ever been experienced in this climate before, Washington recently wrote. In all, 28 snowstorms will ravage this winter encampment, with one particularly devastating January blizzard leaving behind snowdrifts taller than the 6'2" Washington. The haphazard log huts of Valley Forge have been replaced here in Morristown by neat rows of housing for officers and enlisted men. But appearances are deceiving. Food and clothing are once again in short supply. Morale is at a low, and desertion is rampant. Of those who remain in camp, some are more likely to mutiny than re-enlist. Indeed, a New Year's Day insurrection by soldiers from Pennsylvania led to the shooting death of a young captain. 1 week later, when spies informed British Commander-in-Chief Henry Clinton of the incident, he boldly sent a messenger to Middletown offering cash to those men on the American side willing to defect and fight for the English. The soldiers from Pennsylvania refused, a fact that did not prevent Lieutenant Colonel Alexander Hamilton from writing to a fellow officer about the sad state of American independence. "Our countrymen have all the folly of the ass and all the passiveness of the sheep in their compositions. They are determined not to be free, and they can neither be frightened, discouraged, nor persuaded to change their resolution." This is by far the lowest point in the war for Washington and his army. For Hamilton, however, the Morristown encampment is a boon. His social life has taken on new meaning. He is quite fond of dancing, parties, and the pursuit of the fairer sex. It is common for local society to visit Morristown for an occasional evening of dancing and making merry. It was on one such occasion in February that Alexander Hamilton met and fell in love with a brunette named Elizabeth Schuyler, the 22-year-old daughter of General Philip Schuyler. The 23-year-old Hamilton is utterly smitten, and for the first time in years, he has turned his intense focus from the war. The man who still believes that a soldier should have no other wife than the service now finds room in his life for affairs of the heart. In the words of Lieutenant Colonel Tench Tileman, his roommate at Morristown, and another of General Washington's bright young aides, "Hamilton is a gone man." Writing to his good friend Lieutenant Colonel John Lawrence, son of Henry Lawrence, who is now among the men battling to save the city of Charleston, Hamilton describes Elizabeth in typically precise detail. She is a good-hearted girl who, I am sure, will never play the termagant. Footnote, an archaic word meaning a harsh woman. End footnote. Though not a genius, she has good sense enough to be agreeable, and though not a beauty, she has fine black eyes, is rather handsome, and has every other requisite of the exterior to make a lover happy. And believe me, I am a lover in earnest, though I do not speak of the perfections of my mistress in the enthusiasm of chivalry. Hamilton's letters to Elizabeth, whom he calls Eliza, are more romantic. I have told you, and I told you truly, that I love you too much. You engross my thoughts too entirely to allow me to think anything else. I meet you in every dream, and when I wake, I cannot close my eyes again for ruminating on your sweetness. The turn in Hamilton's romantic life has begun to strain his relationship with George Washington. After almost 3 years of serving side by side, each has seen the other at his best and worst. Hamilton now longs not just for the favors of Elizabeth, but also to command men in battle, an honor Washington has already bestowed upon Hamilton's good friend Lawrence, who is just 25, and also on the Frenchman Lafayette, a man 2 years younger than Hamilton, and who has been commanding American troops in battle for years. Elizabeth, in fact, has saved Hamilton from the deep despair that enveloped him when Lawrence was ordered south to join the fighting. All-consuming and all-important, the war has come to define Washington, Hamilton, and Lafayette in ways that none of them could have imagined when hostilities broke out 5 years ago. More and more Americans are growing tired of the fighting and openly long for reconciliation with England, yet these driven three will not relent until the war is won. The British, meanwhile, gleefully exult in the belief that the American collapse is imminent. So very contemptible is the rebel force now in all parts, and so vast is our superiority everywhere, Lord George Germain will write to British Commander-in-Chief General Henry Clinton, no resistance on their part shall be apprehended that can materially obstruct the progress of the King's arms in the speedy suppression of the rebellion. That suppression is no longer focused on the battlefields of New Jersey, Pennsylvania, and New York. Other than minor skirmishes, there has been no fighting between the armies of George Washington and Henry Clinton since Monmouth, almost 20 months ago. Capturing New York City and taking control of the North has always been General Washington's objective, but now he spends his time in a defensive position rather than attacking. The hub of the rebel strategy has moved to the fort at West Point, 50 miles up the Hudson River from New York City. Footnote. Washington meant to attack New York in a joint land and sea invasion as early as July 8, 1778, after the battle at Monmouth. However, he was forced to remain in a defensive stance outside the city for a number of reasons, including the reluctance of the French fleet to sail into New York Harbor to engage the British Navy. The British have superiority in troop strength, and the rebel force is further compromised due to a lack of pay, clothing, food, and an all-around national fatigue over the war. The British officers' decision to focus their strategy on the South further weakened the size of Washington's fighting force when it became necessary to shift men from the North to the Southern theater. End footnote. While Washington waits in New Jersey, General Clinton and his troops are heading south, leaving behind a skeleton defensive force of British regulars, Loyalists, and Hessian mercenaries to fend off Washington's troops should they decide to move. With the vital southern port of Savannah now in British hands, General Clinton sets his sights on the crown jewel of Charleston, the most important seaport south of Annapolis. Only when Charleston is captured will Clinton return to the comfort of New York City, there to serve out the war. The British plan is simple. Regain possession of the colonies one at a time by taking advantage of the large number of Loyalists in the South. Soon the British army in the South will reunite with their army in the North in a great pincer-like movement, crushing Washington and his forces once and for all. To the West, the Americans are hemmed in by the Indian nations allied to the British, who throughout the war have conducted raids along the frontier forests of New York and Pennsylvania, and the settlements in the new territory of Kentucky. While the French were once considered America's saviors, thus far they have been no help at all. Their navy sails for home at the first sign of a storm rather than fight, and without a naval presence, there is no way Washington can stop Clinton and his redcoats from sailing up and down the coastline or making landfall to attack wherever they like. This is now Britain's war to win, and George Washington knows it. Their first step is to capture Charleston. By April 14th, the British Army and Navy have almost surrounded the century-old port. The loss of Charleston would be catastrophic, the largest American defeat thus far in the war. Thousands of American soldiers would be taken prisoner should Charleston fall. Hundreds of precious cannon and muskets would be lost. The Americans are outnumbered almost 3-1, and George Washington has been able to send only a few thousand troops to aid the Southern Army under the command of General Benjamin Lincoln. In truth, the British and Americans both believe that the looming battle is already lost. There is little chance for a rebel victory. The lone glimmer of American hope is that Charleston is not completely surrounded. American wagons use a single narrow dirt road to ferry food, ammunition, weapons, and outside communications into the embattled port. The precious artery meanders from Charleston out into the South Carolina backcountry, crossing the broad and languid Cooper River via the Biggin Bridge, just past Monk's Corner. Should this road remain open, the Americans can hold out or, at the very least, flee the city before it falls. But if the British gain control of the road, American troops inside Charleston will be trapped. Now, just before 3 a.m. on April 14th, at a location 30 miles northwest of Charleston, Lieutenant Colonel Banastre Tarleton and his British Legion march forth to seize the vital road. Yesterday, a captured slave revealed the precise location of the American troops. Tarleton knows that the rebel cavalry controls the Biggin Bridge, but reconnaissance says American infantry units are sleeping in a meeting house overlooking the Cooper River waterfront, with others scattered up and down the river's banks. In exchange for a small bribe, the slave leads Tarleton's men toward the bridge via seldom-used local trails that shield their presence. Thick forests and blackwater rivers, home to venomous copperheads and cottonmouths, hem in the path on both sides, making this corridor very dangerous indeed. The night air is damp, but not cold. As the British draw closer, Tarleton listens for the telltale signs of an ambush, the click of a musket being cocked, the inadvertent whine of a cannon wheel in need of grease, creaking branches betraying soldiers taking up positions in a thicket. But he hears nothing. To his surprise, there is no evidence of a cavalry patrol guarding the road. Though raised the son of a slave-trading politician in industrial Liverpool, Tarleton is used to the sounds of war. An officer in a regiment that remained in Great Britain, he volunteered to serve in this war and has been a part of the British fighting machine in America since almost the beginning of hostilities. As a 21-year-old cornet, he participated in the capture of American General Charles Lee in December 1776. His good conduct on this raid advanced Tarleton's career immeasurably. Promoted to brigade major and now lieutenant colonel in command of his own newly formed regiment, Tarleton has fought in almost every theater of the war. Thus far, in those many days of fighting, Banastre Tarleton has not shown a proclivity for evil. His weaknesses are gambling and women, vices common to many soldiers. Neither presents a problem on the battlefield. Indeed, these shortcomings were easily overlooked 1 year ago when General Henry Clinton gave Tarleton command of the Royal Brigade. But on this night, something changes in Lieutenant Colonel Tarleton. He will no longer feel the need to behave like an officer and a gentleman. At 3 o'clock in the morning, the advanced guard of dragoons and mounted infantry approached the American post, as Tarleton will describe the raid. A watchword was immediately communicated to the officers and soldiers, which was immediately followed by an order to charge the enemy's grand guard on the main road. The order was executed with the greatest promptitude and success. The Americans were completely surprised. The flustered cavalry commanders, George Washington's distant cousin William among them, are so astonished that they flee into the swamp, running rather than taking their chances fighting the British. By Tarleton's estimation, well over 100 prime Carolina horses are captured, allowing him to personally select the mount that best suits his needs. The British force also seizes food, weapons, and clothing while routing the Americans. Tarleton's troops charge into the meeting house with bayonets fixed, oblivious to the sounds of rebel soldiers wishing to surrender. The slaughter is horrifying. The soldiers stab to death Americans who put up no resistance. One French officer, the Major Chevalier Pierre-François Vernier, is slashed behind the ear by a saber and then repeatedly cut, mangled in the most shocking manner, in the words of one loyalist eyewitness. The abuse continues right up to the moment of Vernier's death. In all, 15 American enlisted men and 5 officers are killed. Hundreds more flee into the night, leaving the British in complete control of Biggin Bridge. Adding to the carnage, Tarleton allows his soldiers to abuse the female camp followers, who are now undefended. In the wake of the fighting, 2 dragoons on a foraging mission travel from Monk's Corner to Fairlawn, a local plantation. The owner is Lady Jane Colleton, a widow and prominent loyalist whose husband died 3 years ago. Despite her loyalist stance, Tarleton's soldiers attempt to rape her, but she fights them off, only to be slashed by a sword. Another woman is not so lucky. 36-year-old Anne Faisou begs Tarleton's men to take her life and not to violate her person. Mrs. Faisou's pleas are ignored. She is attacked with a sword, strangled, and finally raped. She survives, but is never the same. For the next 4 weeks, Bannister Tarleton and his loyalists lay siege to the surrounding countryside, sealing the road out of Charleston in the process. The fierce band roams the South Carolina countryside, seeking out and destroying any remaining rebel resistance. On May 6th, Tarleton obliterates the remnants of the American cavalry at Leonard's Ferry, a crossing point on the Santee River. Men on horseback are crucial in the South, where villages are farther apart than in the North, making the loss of enormous consequence to the rebels. Now that he is in control, Tarleton's scorched earth policy quickly becomes the talk of the South. General Clinton will write to Tarleton, "I wish you would get 3 legions and divide yourself into 3 parts. We can do no good without you." It has now become a hopeless situation for the Americans trapped inside Charleston. George Washington had ordered General Benjamin Lincoln to retreat once the city became indefensible. Lincoln instead took pity on the city's civilian population, whose leadership pleaded that Continental troops remain there to protect them. Now, more than 5,000 American soldiers and sailors are surrounded by a British army and navy numbering 13,500. Making matters even worse, some ungrateful citizens of Charleston have pledged to burn any American boats that might be used to evacuate Lincoln's troops by sea. On May 12th, after 40 days and nights under siege, Charleston falls. The defeat is a stunning blow, giving the British complete control of Georgia and South Carolina. More than 5,000 officers and enlisted men are taken prisoner, the most Continental soldiers to surrender so far in the war. Footnote: members of local militias were not taken prisoner, but instead allowed to return to their homes in exchange for not taking up arms against the British again. General Lincoln was held for a few months and then exchanged in a prisoner swap. The American Congress launched an investigation into his behavior, but it was never concluded. End footnote. 3 signers of the Declaration of Independence, Thomas Hayward, Edward Rutledge, and Arthur Middleton, are arrested and held in a dungeon at the city's exchange. Fearing that they would somehow maintain contact with rebel elements still roaming the Carolina backcountry, all 3 will soon be transferred to a prison in faraway St. Augustine, Florida. More than 1,000 of the captured American soldiers will spend the next year in Charleston Harbor, suffering in aging ships that have been stripped of all nautical accoutrement and transformed into floating prisons. Conditions will be horrid inside these hell holes, which reek of filth and teem with vermin. In time, many of these men will become walking skeletons, for there is little food. Disease will rampage through the confined air of the packed holds, and men will die from tuberculosis, typhus, cholera, and smallpox. One American prisoner will describe life aboard a British prison ship. At sundown, we were ordered down between the decks to the number of nearly 300 of us. The best lodging I could procure this night was on a chest, almost suffocated with the heat and stench. I expected to die before morning, but human nature can bear more than one would at first suppose. The want of bedding and the loss of all my clothes rendered me wretched indeed. An estimated 500 prisoners will break under the cruelty and accept a British offer to join their ranks. These men will be sent to serve on the tropical island of Jamaica to prevent their once again joining the rebel cause. Yet even in the midst of this suffering, there is compassion. A woman named Elizabeth Hutchinson Jackson makes it a point to visit the incarcerated Americans, nursing those suffering from cholera. She is just 43, but so haggard from years of struggle and the loss of a husband and two sons that a friend describes her as a fair-haired, very conservative old Irish lady. Footnote: Elizabeth Jackson's husband died in a logging accident at the age of 29. The tragedy occurred just weeks before the birth of his youngest son and namesake. His other two sons, Hugh and Robert, died as soldiers during the Revolutionary War at the respective ages of 16 and 17. End footnote. Jackson well knows the name Bannistra Tarleton, for the British Legion rode into her town shortly after the fall of Charleston and surprised the local militia, massacring more than 100 rebel soldiers, many of whom were trying to surrender. A new term was coined that day, Tarleton's Quarter, which means no quarter at all. On that terrible day, Jackson tended the dying in a local Presbyterian church and also watched as her 13-year-old son became so enraged by the slaughter that he begged to join the fight. Eventually, the Continental Army took him on as a scout and messenger. Shortly thereafter, the boy was taken captive by Tarleton's men. A British lieutenant slashed him across the face with a saber for refusing to clean mud from his boots and then sent him to a backcountry prison camp. It was Elizabeth who personally brokered her son's release, but not before he almost died of starvation and smallpox. Now, attempting to alleviate the suffering of those incarcerated in Charleston Harbor is a Herculean task for Jackson, one made all the more difficult by the British insistence on viewing the captives as terrorists and adding to their misery with daily doses of mental and physical torture. Inevitably, Jackson, an immigrant from Carrickfergus, Ireland, succumbs to cholera. At a time when so many are dying, her passing is a footnote and her place of burial forever lost to history. But while Elizabeth Hutchinson Jackson can no longer help the cause of freedom, the rescue of her son from a British prison will have an enduring legacy. For his name is Andrew Jackson. And one day, during the War of 1812, he will get his revenge on the British at the Battle of New Orleans, after which he will become the 7th President of the United States.